Man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is episode 657. Jason Lindgren is with me and Luke returns. You may remember Luke from a past episode, 650. You'll want to catch that one. He's rejoining us today. He's been doing a lot of work trying to further ideas that have been around for quite some time. As a matter of fact, he's of a mind that he might be improving these things. He is of a mind that he might be establishing proofs. So it's very interesting. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a very warm and fine good day it is.
I wish it was. It's dark here. Anyhow, welcome, Luke. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely. I loved being on here for the first episode, and a lot of your listeners, they're really great people, in all honesty.
Appreciate it. If there are any websites or anything, contact you want to lay down, now would be the moment.
Just afterwards, if anybody wants to email me, it's the email capital D, capital E, capital T, and then all lowercase theory at proton.me.
All right. So we're going to open up with Walter Russell and Schrodinger. Most people know about Schrodinger these days because of the show Big Bang, which was biggest in the world not too long ago, where they introduced a version of the idea of Schrodinger's cat. I don't think a lot of people knew about Schrodinger who weren't science-minded. But Walter Russell, we've had a number of people on from the Walter Russell establishment. We've had people on. We apparently played a key role in helping them survive COVID because so many of you out there went and got the books. It really helped them. So in reverse, thank you guys all for that. But let's jump in, Luke. Cue us up. Who was Walter Russell? Who was Schrodinger?
So Schrodinger, he was what some consider to be a founding quantum physicist. So very early on in quantum, he released some of his work that was brought into quantum to kind of help answer some of the questions that in its early infancy were really big questions. And then as far as Russell goes, I mean, his work that he laid out, in my opinion, it's really incredible. And it's very interesting to see how somebody that didn't have the, I guess you could say, the scientific background kind of laid these things out in the way that he did. And for the most part, it matches a lot of things that at least now to this day and age, we know as like actual facts, actual empirical stuff. Now, there are some little here and there's honestly between the both of them that we will go into. But truth be told, I mean, when we look at even the births, Schrodinger was born in 87 in Austria-Hungary, and Russell was born in 71 in Boston. So these two individuals were from very different worlds, but they were also contemporaries at the time. And the parallel that their work shows and what we'll be getting into is absolutely wild.
There's so many interesting things about Russell when you start laying down the dates, because he was born and died on the same date. And just so people out there know, Russell is kind of unique, as Luke stated. I think mostly he might have been trained as an artist, if I remember correctly. But then he lays down, he redoes the periodic table, which, by the way, I've always had a problem with the periodic table, but unfortunately, I am not bright enough in science to say a whole heck of a lot about it. But he claimed that he experienced an illumination for something close to a month. And interestingly enough, that happened in May as well. So I just wanted to get that in there so they realize when you said, you know, he had no training, where did all this come from? Well, he claimed he was illuminated for 30 some odd days and that he witnessed it all firsthand. That was his claim.
And, you know, in all honesty, like looking at his work, I really don't think I could call him out on saying like, oh, you didn't experience what you said you did. Because as far as like the depth of the work that he laid out, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, it had to have happened, honestly.
Well, if I remember correctly, again, he wanted to get a book out, or a doctor friend of his said, you've got to get this published. He said, I don't have the funds or something like that. And the doctor basically, out of his own pocket, with no hope or no idea of getting repaid, paid to get it published. And anyone out there who's gotten a version of the Universal One, the older ones, it is a gorgeous book. It's embossed in gold, not real gold, but gold. And it's a hardback, deep, deep blue. It's a gorgeous book. And the first guy he showed it to thought it was so important, he ponied up the cash to get it published.
I can say, at least on my part, after looking through some of this, I'm pretty grateful that he actually did that.
I appreciate all the hand-drawn stuff, but I got to ask you, Luke, how do you feel about the periodic table that sat in our classrooms?
So looking at the standard periodic table and looking at Russell's, I can tell you that they are, I mean, obviously they're for the most part, the same thing as like the elements that they have in them, but obviously the ordering is a little bit different. The reason I would say that is because both of these show two different things. So even though they're both showing the periodic table, or at least a table of the elements, they have two different purposes behind them of like exactly what they're showing. And that is one thing that will be made very clear later on, to where like the standard periodic table that we know of, it works off of basically atomic numbers, weights, protons, all of that. Russell's does not work off of that. And again, like I said, we'll go over that part in a little bit, but you'll see very soon exactly what Russell was modeling, whether he realized it or not.
Oh, are you of a mind that he didn't realize it?
I think he, even though he modeled it in this specific way, I guess I would say I don't know if he realizes how in depth exactly what he modeled was and how many details are actually in there.
All right. Well, you've got my interest, but I will point out he did title it the Universal One. That's pretty deep.
I guess maybe not deep, but the detail that's in it that he may not have realized is there.
Okay.
So getting into the works, at least the major works, and I mean, both of these individuals have additional works that they have besides these specific ones, but these are mainly two of the ones that we're going to be talking about today. But as far as Erwin Schrödinger goes, Jason, if you would please.
Quantus Serium als Eigenwert Problem.
And then we have Walter Russell's The Universal One. So again, of course, they both have additional works that they have. But as far as what we're talking about today, these are going to be the two major ones. Now, originally, whenever I was trying to plan this episode, I thought about playing a little game to where we do a what quote is whose, because both of these individuals run so parallel that their famous quotes are very, very similar. And if it wasn't for the fact that I know that there are so many Russell fans out there that would be able to pick his quote off the rip, I would have done it like that. But as far as Schrödinger, one of the most famous quotes that he has is, "Multiplicity is only apparent. In truth, there is only one mind." And this comes from his lecture and his book for What is Life? And then, of course, for Russell, we have All Things Are One and All Things Are But One. And his just constant emphasis on a universal or just one mind,
which is completely laid out when you look at his version of what we call the periodic table.
Right, exactly. Just from their simple quotes, like you can see that these two individuals are already from the very get-go, at least thinking in the same kind of way as far as like a universal idea, right?
So I had to look it up real quick. I was going to ask you if Schrödinger was spiritual, but according to Wikipedia, his mother was Lutheran and he was an atheist, believe it or not. He had a strong, it claims here, maybe I shouldn't even be using this source, but it claims here he had a strong interest in Eastern religions.
Yes. So now we get into kind of one of the interesting things about Schrödinger, right? So that quote that I gave you, there's actually debate on that quote itself. So just as many of like the truther community have controversy with some of the most famous individuals, for Schrödinger, it's actually kind of the opposite. So there are a lot of physicists in general that have controversy over a quantum foundational individual making a spiritual quote like this.
Uh-huh.
And many will actually go and argue all day long that it's actually a translation error, because when he originally made it, it was in German. But truth be told, I think we have a pretty good concept of how German is translated to other languages. So I think it is kind of written how it is. And, you know, if you want to interpret it for how it is, then that's great. And if you are somebody that wants to say, oh, that's not what he meant, then all power to you with that as well.
So wait a minute, are you pointing out that the science establishment detected a hint of spiritualism? They made an issue of it. Is that what you're pointing out?
Yes. And this is actually it's not an extremely recent thing, but it's just a more recent thing. I would say over the past maybe probably 15, 20 years, maybe.
Well, I told you when we were off the air, one of the things Russell said was the biggest problem with modern science is they've removed the creator from the creation they're studying, which I accept wholeheartedly. And it's interesting that you pointed out how many of these high level quantum guys and others like that got stuff pinned to their name, because at the bottom of this wiki page, they're starting to do the same thing to Schrodinger, believe it or not, but they're doing it through sexual abuse allegations. They now have the whole bottom of his wiki entry is sexual abuse allegations. So that seems like defaming after the fact, although I have no idea if there's a here or a there to it.
Well, physicists are also notoriously atheistic, are they not?
Yes, and I would say it really depends on what field they're in. It seems like some fields kind of have not necessarily a preference, but it's more like the way that they interpret the data of their field, it kind of pushes them in that direction. Or it could actually be that the foundation of that field in general and what it's about, what it does, attracts individuals that already have that mindset. So it's kind of like, I don't know which one really came first.
Well, I think there's an easy way we can illustrate what we're talking about here. If you go look at the periodic table, it's hypermaterialism, it's sterile, it's weighed and measured. If you go look at Walter Russell's ideas, they're, I don't want to say elegant, that's not the right word, they're flowing, they're anything but sterile, they're anything but weighed and measured. It's a more holistic view in my mind. And I think that's really the difference that I notice when I look at these things.
I mean, one of his major things that he spoke about was just talking about inertia, talking about movement, talking about live things, talking about a constant movement or evolution that is going on.
Magnetism, he talked a lot about.
Right. And his entire depictions that he made, his entire just descriptions that he had for things, everything was constantly moving. Everything was constantly alive. There was no real dead space there, I guess you could say.
All things in motion.
Exactly.
Well, I want to get back to where you were going here, because basically, as I pointed out, the reason anyone these days knows about Schrodinger is because he was on a sitcom and they put Schrodinger's cat in everyone's mind. He's kind of a mainstream icon for his field, right? But what you're doing is you're showing a parallel to someone like Russell, who is anything but a mainstream icon. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of a mind that there was intention to try to shut that establishment down and starve it out during COVID, as they did to so many. So get back to those parallels, if you could, so we can kind of finish that out, because what you're saying is this mainstream icon is saying very similar things to this, you know, outsider.
Oh, absolutely. And as we go on, so specifically the thought experiment of Schrodinger's cat, not a lot of people realize that that came much, much later on from Schrodinger, like way before the foundational work that he put out. So this was really kind of at a point where he wasn't having as much of a major impact on the development of quantum. So his wave function equation, I mean, definitely had a very, very large impact. But once we got to the point of probability, he, for the most part, kind of stepped away from it. And we will actually be going into why that more than likely that actually is. After he came out with all of his papers, laid the foundation of wave mechanics, he kind of took up a more teaching role. And I mean, this could be because, you know, the wars were going on during this time, all of that, and a lot of people in that area kind of had to move around a good bit, so nobody could ever really set up shop that much anymore. But there is a reason, at least in my opinion, as to why he took a step back away from the rest of quantum and how it was developing.
Just for the record, they're claiming that this was his thought experiment that he came up with in 1935. But in Wikipedia, get this, it was in a discussion with, wait for it, guess who? Albert Einstein.
Yes. So he did have a lot of letters back and forth with Einstein. And there was a point in time to where Einstein actually cut contact with him just because of personal decisions that Schrodinger made. Because again, remember the war was going on and a lot of people were, I guess you could say, doing things that they didn't want to do, right?
Some people were pitching for the wrong team.
Yeah. Yeah. And whether that was just out of a need to do it or a want to do it at this point in time, who knows anymore?
What are some of the big items that you see as completely parallel between Russell and Schrodinger?
So one of Schrodinger's major, major accomplishments was a equation that he established that's called the harmonic wave function solution, right? So obviously there's already a word in there that kind of piques your interest a little bit, right? And that word is indeed harmonic. The way his equation that he established really works is it sets up the entire wave function for really just energy as a whole. Now, when we look at what Russell was saying, and then, you know, at this point in time, we're much, much further into the future, and we can kind of look at what he's saying and kind of put an equation to it, right? So if we look at what he's saying, for the most part, it's literally the same exact thing to where you have harmonic standing waves, right? So we're already talking about harmonics again, then getting into octaves, getting into rhythmic motion, dealing with the situation of a center of stillness, or what he described. Realistically, these two statements from these two different individuals, when you look at what they are saying and actually put a picture to it, it's the same exact thing. To where if you wanted to actually do a one-for-one translation of what they're saying, Schrodinger is saying the harmonic wave function is the spatial wave function multiplied by the energy level. Russell's saying the harmonic wave function or octave wave function is the spatial function shaped by the octave structure centered on stillness. They're really the same exact thing. They're saying how energy acts in waveform around a center, and how does that energy become shaped, and how does it look, and how does the actual wave function play out? Now, if you want the only difference between what they are actually saying, it's that Schrodinger's equation has a time function to it. So in short, Schrodinger's saying what happens when a energetic structure receives energy and then releases it. And we know this as a photon. So this would be a excitation state of, like, say, a hydrogen atom, right?
So a particle.
I wouldn't necessarily say a particle. So
is it the idea that it's both then?
Kind of. So a photon is light, right? So like what we think of just right off the rip of light, you know, the stuff that illuminates, makes stuff visible, that is a photon, which works kind of in a waveform way. It does have some particle attributes to it, but in all honesty, I would say ignore really the particle part of it. At least that's what quantum does.
What does mainstream consider it? Would they consider it a particle or both, or how would they consider it?
So they would say it has wave-particle duality to it, to where it can act like a wave, it can act like a particle. It just depends on what's going on in that specific scenario.
Having to do with an observer and all that?
So the whole observer idea is actually part of the old interpretation. These days, most agree that the observer effect actually has nothing to do with it, and that it is based off of which path information is available or not.
Okay, the reason I asked is because I'm noticing that he was at a world power conference and was apparently skeptical of nuclear power, and people listening to this podcast know where we are on that. Nukes do not exist as described in our point of view. But it goes on to say that he had gone to the wave alone idea, which must have been a bit of a slap in the face for people who are there to talk about nuclear stuff, isn't it?
It could be.
They're calling it a controversy, so that's basically all I can tell you.
Yeah, I could definitely see how like a field as far as like nuclear physics go, where you're dealing with, for the most part, particles, for you to just go strictly off of wave function, I could definitely see how they would be aghast at that.
Well, it's interesting because they're claiming that he was there in 1955 at the World Power Conference, which implies they had already claimed they'd used two nukes on Japan. And here he is being skeptical about nuclear power. Anyhow, I don't want to pull you off topic. So
no, I could see that, though, because you're talking about somebody that has literally modeled the most detailed parts and inner workings of a atom at that current time.
Okay.
I mean, you're talking about the individual that literally laid out the function of energy within a nucleus as well as the electron, right? Now, okay. Most people would say that I kind of took a step too far when I said nucleus, but there is a reason for that. And we will actually get into that once we go through Russell's periodic chart.
So Schrodinger did that for the particle.
He did that for quantum, which only works really in waveform. They don't really deal with particles.
Got it. Because the claim here is everyone there was about wave-particle duality, and he came in promoting the wave-only idea, poo-pooing their precious nuclear power. But anyhow, go ahead, carry on.
Right. So Schrodinger's had a time dependency on it, or a time factor on it. So it was a... You could say an atom that receives energy and then releases it as a photon. So this would be what we know as an excitation state. Russell was modeling what happens when an atom receives energy and holds on to it. That is the only difference. So while Schrodinger modeled excitation and the release of that energy, Russell modeled it holding on and basically the evolution of the wave function as it held on to that energy.
Okay.
So like you could very loosely say, think about how fusion works, but instead of thinking particles, think waveform. So when there's a combination, or in all honesty, you could even think of it as a chemical reaction or transmutation, what happens to that energy in waveform when it's holding on to it?
What does happen?
Well, it evolves to something else.
This is Russell's approach you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So if we go back to thinking about octaves, tones, even overtones, you could also put it in another way, in a more musical analogy to it, to where Russell tracked different tones within octaves, Schrodinger tracked a tone going off key and then returning to its natural tone. And this off key tone is expelled or emitted as a photon. So Schrodinger himself is probably one of my favorite, what you could call, foundational individuals for quantum. So he was very, very bright, very smart, a genius overall. I mean, I would say the same thing for Russell. But as far as quantum goes, Schrodinger is definitely one of my favorite individuals. So again, going back to his thought experiment, this came much later on in his work that he was doing. But as far as early on, and at least in the first papers where he introduced his wave function equation, it was never meant for probability. So he wanted it to be completely deterministic. He never wanted it to be anywhere near probability. So these days where you see somebody reference probability density, meaning the chance that you will find a electron within this area. So that's based off of probability. What he was actually modeling when he first introduced his wave function equation was energy density.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing you're saying there, because you're saying he wanted no theoretical probability, any of that. He wanted it to be what it is, but the whole world is introduced to his name through the cat, which is complete probability.
Exactly.
So that's interesting because it almost appears that they're pushing the probability connection on purpose.
Yeah, I would, whether you want to consider it a lack of just additional information of the day and age, or whether you want to say it's a push of probability. I mean, I think there's enough on both sides to argue either side. Because the way that we actually got to probability is, again, originally he wanted it to represent energy density, but there was another foundational individual of quantum named Born that, due to the interpretations from like double slit experiments, he took that wave function equation, modified it a little bit, and then it became probability density. Now, one interesting thing about that is when he did that, Schrodinger actually had a reply to it. And his reply was, I don't like it, and I wish I never had anything to do with it. So he was absolutely not for this whatsoever.
So what he intended had been bent and misshaped.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he wanted it to be completely deterministic, to where there's no probability. Everything is basically accounted for. We know all cause and effect. We are, for the most part, I mean, you could say we're trying to actually figure out what's going on instead of just kind of hand-waving it as probability.
Who was responsible for twisting his concept?
Born. So he was another quantum physicist at the time.
So when you see a guy who wants to be, this is this, one and one is two, there's no gray area, we're not doing theoretical, we're observing, it means this, they turn around and they shoehorn some probability in there, then decades later, on the most popular TV show in the world, they reintroduce his name, because most people walking aren't going to know it unless they're in that field, with the cat idea, which is complete probability. I don't think you can convince me that there isn't an absolute push to shoehorn the probability idea and get rid of we can solve things and know things idea.
So another interesting thing is that, you know, we've been dealing with probability for a decently long time now, right? I mean, this was, you know, introduced back in the 20s. It is gotten to the point to where some physicists will actually state that probability is so well known that you could reference it as deterministic, meaning that we know how well the probability will work in this situation that you could label it as deterministic. And another interesting thing about that is where Schrodinger originally wanted it to represent energy density, and which then turned to probability. There are a good amount of physicists now that when they reference this situation, they've actually come full turn back to referencing it as energy density. They no longer actually refer to it as probability.
Yeah, I mean, it just appears that they're purposely trying to skew it. And then, of course, I pointed out that at the bottom of his wiki page, they're defaming him now, claiming that they've unnamed thing and take his pictures down based on claims for a man who's been gone for quite some time. To me, that seems like, whether it was true or not, to do the effort to do that, that they're purposefully smearing a name.
Yeah, I think it's a little, definitely a little too coincidental. I mean, you can read about some of the, I guess you could say, promiscuous activities that he had. But as far as what they're claiming, I mean, again, if the information is there and it's factual, it's one of those situations to where it is what it is. But it kind of seems like one just ripped out of their current playbook that they typically throw on individuals.
It seems to me like the man that you're introducing that I didn't know a whole heck of a lot about was edging into things that jive with Russell, which makes him an outsider to the clean, sterile, weighed, and measured scientific matrix that we're aware of. Because if you go down through, he was very interested in color. And these are the types of things Jason and I have covered. A man named Dinshaw used color light to literally heal people. And they came at him with the howitzers blazing. he had thousands of these machines in the world and they made them all outlaw. And you go down here on Schrodinger and what's he doing? He's doing color. And this is almost the alchemical point of view if you think about it.
Yeah. And actually, one interesting thing about that is not too many people are actually familiar with this, but in quantum, there is, I guess you could say, a subfield of it called quantum chromodynamics, to where when they're modeling quarks, they will actually assign colors to them. And these colors will kind of indicate at what stage they're at. So like whether they're ready to actually combine into a larger particle. So like in the event that you get two up quarks and one down quark, you get a proton. Or if you have two down quarks and one up quark, you get a neutron. But they actually use this color system for calculating how these are actually like ready to bind, so to speak. And they're actually advancing that even further to where now they're doing different color combinations in order to try to get like what we call white light and see what kind of interactions those are going to cause.
So are the colors made in nature or assigned in a lab?
So those colors specifically, as far as chromodynamics work, those are actually assigned.
Okay.
I would not say that those quarks specifically exhibit a color that we would associate it with. So like if we're looking at spectral lines of like hydrogen or like lithium or whatever element, and we're associating it with the color of those spectral lines, that's not necessarily the same for these quarks. If anything, they're assigned that color to really just show communication of like what kind of interactions are going to be happening, what stage the quarks are at, and all of that.
How would Schrodinger have taken that? Seems to me probably would have been a guy who, if there was color there, it would have been created color that he was witnessing, having been interested in color perception and colorimetry, something like that.
He probably would have had something very intelligent, but also kind of like backhandish to what they were doing.
Well, you've made the crossover to what Russell was doing, and you know darn well that when you look at those spirals and those octaves, that the color would be assigned by nature, and it would be based on what we would probably call vibration or frequency, and it would not be anything more than what was actually there.
Yes. So I would say that as far as color goes, and I'm someone that thinks that color itself is actually a hard written law within what we call reality, right? So like we have no actual reason or explanation as to why like this frequency emits, like it is viewable as this color of light. So as far as like the visible spectrum goes, there's no reason why red is placed where it's at. There's no reason why blue is placed where it's at. It's just something that we observe.
But wait a minute, you're talking about observed color.
Yes.
That's actually there. That's actually created in a prism from, say, sunlight.
Yes.
Okay.
So as far as why those colors are there and why they are basically locked in to those frequencies, because if you get a frequency for like just the middle of the red spectrum, that is always going to be that part of the red spectrum every single time. That specific frequency is going to be that color. And we have no reason as to why that frequency is that color.
Well, I think that's kind of addressed in not a direct way in what Russell's showing. In half of the things that he shows where he's talking about gender, octaves, there's always red and blue and you see it. And he shows the point at which they switch. To me, this is why the spirituality component is important, because that's why it's there in Russell's work.
And it may be something that later on we might figure out the reason as to why this frequency is this color. And it might be something in relation to how he assigns genders, how he assigns the generative force, how he assigns the radiative force. There may be a connection there. But as far as at least where we are now with science, and even going on into the individuals that do treat science and spirituality as parallel fields, we don't have a solid reason as to why they are associated with what they are.
Well, I could be wrong, but isn't that a little bit like saying, why is magnetism magnetic?
No, we have a reason for that.
Okay.
So magnetism, all it is either atoms or molecules, whichever one you want to consider it, they are aligned and oriented. That is what magnetism is. That is what it does. That's what it locks them into, an aligned and orientated lattice to where everything is flowing all together. So this is another thing a lot of people don't know is, of course, everything has atoms in it. It has molecules in it, lattices, all of that. As long as the magnetic force is strong enough, every single thing in existence can be magnetized. Because again, all it is atoms or molecules aligned and orientated.
Now, is it Russell that said magnetism is not attractive but repellent? Do I have that right, or is that not Russell?
I think he said something along the lines of that. And this is one of the, I guess you could say, corrections that I would give Russell. And this is where I would ask you and everybody that is a fan of Russell that's listening, there are some corrections that I would give to his work, which will further explain in depth exactly what he's showing in his graphs and depictions that he has. And what I ask is that I understand some people don't like when individuals like this are corrected, or however you want to say it, but understand that I'm doing this to further show and give more backing to what he said. And in all honesty, at the end of it, it's going to even further verify and even show a better picture of exactly what he was doing, even to the point to where I don't think he realized at the time exactly what all he was doing.
In the old days, that's how things were improved. Someone came along, took something, came up with a new idea, provided the proofs. The proofs went out to the people who understand at that level, and it either gets accepted, or even if it's not, if it's something like math, it either maths or it don't math. So it's a correction when it's accepted or proven, but that's what you're supposed to do. If you have ideas that you think improve on it, you lay them down and show what you have to back it.
Right. And I would say that's typically how we should always be.
Used to be that way, kind of.
Yeah. And it's just some people really don't accept, I guess you could say, criticism. So just know that, like, I am giving Russell the absolute most respect. Because originally, whenever I put out my, while I was working through my own theory with DET, I actually didn't know of Russell at the time. And it wasn't until later on, after I released DET and I was talking to Rose, that she brought up Russell's work. And as soon as I saw his periodic chart, I was like, oh my God, I know exactly what that is. And then after going into his actual explanations and descriptions and what he was talking about, I would say a good amount of it is absolutely on par. Some of it needs a little bit of correction here and there, but as far as what he achieved at the end, like, I recognized it right off the rip and I knew exactly what he did.
Well, I would give you a hint. When you're going to come in to someone like Russell or anyone with a name and an idea, you should offer that you may have improvements and then show what you've got, because the correction can't be claimed until after it's either shown or accepted. But I'm all in. Lay it down. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, and that's that kind of viewpoint is, in my opinion, what helped me lay out DET in the exact manner that it is, to where it gives credit to the ones that came before, but we kind of introduce little corrections here and there. So getting into what Russell got correct, where there are little corrections here and there. So we can start by the way that he treated magnetic fields, right? So how the E field and B field interact with each other, to where E fields are an energy field and B fields are the magnetic field. So from Maxwell's work, we learn the relation of B fields to E fields, and they work orthogonally to where, simply put, they work at a 90 degree angle. So like when you have energy in motion, you have a magnetic field that develops around that E field or around that energy moving in a certain handiness. So it's always going to spin in a certain direction in relation to the direction that that energy field is moving, right? So like when we think about the magnetic field that develops around a wire, right? So that all comes from Maxwell's original work with E and B fields and how B fields work orthogonally or at a 90 degree to E fields. Russell didn't treat magnetism as it was orthogonally to it, but also, truth be told, the depictions that he gives in his work, they don't really have a huge impact on them from the magnetic field. So really, he's just showing kind of E fields, right?
And you did read the Universal One?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, as far as the generative force and the radiative force, so Russell describes the generative force as being positive and the radiative force as being negative, right?
Okay.
Now, to further explain this, we kind of have to look at an analogy, right? Now, in math or in science, we have something called a scalar, something called a vector, something called a matrix, and something called a tensor. So the way that you can easily remember these is that a scalar is a single numerical value, right? So just imagine just a one. Now, a vector extends this into one dimension. So not when you think about multidimensional like places or beings or heaven or Sheol or anything like that. Just imagine a mathematical dimension. So a vector extends this into a direction to where like you have a 1, a 2, and a 3. So where they're aligned either horizontally or they could be aligned vertically. A matrix is the same method, but you add another dimension to it to where you have rows or columns. And then a tensor is another version of this, but more complex to where everything is further organized in there. So like you can imagine a scalar is just the absolute smallest representation of a very, very tiny point within something. Now, these aren't the same scalars that some people reference Tesla speaking about. So the non-Hertzian waves that he spoke of, these are not the same. Although in like DET, for example, I use both the numerical representation and also the non-Hertzian waves that Tesla talked about.
You are officially a quarter of a mile above my head right now.
The good thing is we have I have an analogy to give you.
Okay.
To show what is going on as far as how potential and kinetic energy works, right? So for anybody that doesn't know, potential energy is basically energy that is waiting to do something. And then kinetic energy is energy that is actually doing something, right? So because even quantum uses scalars, so basically just individual units for representation, and I do as well in DET, this kind of gives a new view on what's going on. So we'll use an analogy from fluid dynamics that I feel like most people did like as a little science experiment back in the day in school, to where everybody should understand what I'm talking about.
Okay, I hope so, because you're about to be half a mile over my head. Go ahead.
So we have two cups, right? To where you have cup A and cup B. You can just remember it as cup A is filled with water, cup B is empty. Now you have a straw in the middle, And that is going to play a very special role. So in normal fluid dynamics, we know that cup A is going to empty in cup B, right? Just because of fluid pressure.
Okay.
So as far as that goes, we're kind of going to ignore that a little bit for this analogy. Think of cup A that is full of water as having a high potential, meaning because it has all of the water in it, it has a lot of energy in it that is waiting to do something. Cup B is very low in potential because it's empty. So it's waiting to do something, but because it doesn't have any water in it, it has a very, very low potential. The straw itself is going to act as the kinetic movement of energy. So think of the water as energy. So in the high potential cup, you can view this as positively charged because it has a lot of energy, right? The low potential cup, you can view that as negative because it doesn't have any potential in it really whatsoever. As the fluid moves from cup A into cup B, cup A, as it empties, will lower in potential. So at a certain point in time, its charge will flip from positive to negative, and cup B will flip from negative to positive because it's now receiving the fluid through a kinetic method of getting that water or getting that energy, right?
Okay, but don't they find even between them?
Yes, but not for this analogy.
Okay.
So in fluid dynamics, yes, it does work that way, but this is just to show you how at the smallest level of detail, we now can view charge differently, right? So positive and negative charge. You can view them as high potentials or negative potentials. So cup A has now flipped its sign to where it is a negative charge or a low potential, and cup B has flipped its from negative to positive.
So what is the benefit between identifying it as charge negative or positive or assigning it a potential?
So from Russell's work, where he talks about how energy is generative or radiative, right?
Okay.
For generative, it is viewed as energy coming into a location. So energy is collected at this spot of stillness. He attributes this to a positive charge, while I would attribute this as a negative charge, because we're looking at the center of stillness potential. So originally it was low, so you could view it as negative charge. The generative force is the kinetic movement. So it goes from a negative charge to a positive once it's raised its potential up enough. But generative force in general is a pull. So it's more of a negative than it is a positive.
So having said that, is what you're stating from your point of view put forward on the power of the logic you just applied, or is there something more to establish?
We have to, well, it goes along with the radiative force to where when he views this as negative, I would view this as positive.
As a choice, as a logical idea, why?
Because one, high potential will always flow out energy into a negative potential, right? It kind of works the same way vacuum does.
Which would be true whether you were calling it a potential or negative or positive in the first place, right?
Correct. And you could look at them as the same.
Okay.
So a vacuum, you could look at it as a low potential. It pulls. So if you open up that vacuum, it's going to pull everything in there, right? And it is originally a negative charge to it. So because of this, we can now view the breathing rhythmic descriptions that he's giving a little bit differently to where generative is negative now and radiative is positive. Then you can get an overall view to where, say, a element has its breathing cycle, right? And I use element very loosely here, and we'll get into that as well. But say a element has a breathing aspect to it, but say it radiates more than it generates. So now this element has an overall charge to it. So because it gives more than it actually receives, you could view it as having a overall positive charge attributed to its breathing cycle. Now, if the opposite happens to where it is receiving more than it is actually giving, so its generative force is more than its radiative force, you could view this as being an overall negative element.
I guess, I followed you all the way. I can't establish in my mind why referring it to it one way or the other. I mean, I guess it does slightly change how you think about it. But other than that, I'm completely lost on the benefit.
Because if we're looking at something that is pulsing, right, especially if it's pulsing at an extremely fast rate, each individual detail on what's going on within that energy is extremely, extremely important. So, for example, if you try to put two elements that are overly positive, meaning they both radiate more than they generate, there's not going to be an actual interaction between the two. Like you might have an actual bad interaction, but as far as like any transmutation of like combining or trying to make something else, that's not going to happen. And we'll go over this again when we actually look at the periodic chart, and you can get a more in-depth visual of exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Because it has a lot to do with his diagram he gives for gravitation or generative as well as radiation forces and how charge is actually associated with that. So if you look at his diagrams he gives, he will have like a large positive and then like a small negative. So that means that from his viewpoint, this is a positive moment within the waveform. Positive is the acting force, or if negative is bigger than positive, it is the opposite.
Where I'm getting confused here is like when I look at Russell's, particularly the hand-drawn charts, it comes off to me as if it was labeled negative is because it is, literally. It would literally be female if we were talking gender. It would literally be any other natural thing that would coalesce with the negativity that he's labeled or the negative charge that he's labeled on it. Is that not correct? Are you suggesting that in the way that you just use it, that it's a label so that you can work with it, or that it's literally negatively charged?
So when it comes to charge and when it comes to, say, for example, polarity, these are actually going to be a little bit different than the classical understanding of it. Because again, we're assigning an individual value to each individual point within that energy wave.
And you think that's what, in those diagrams, when Russell puts positive, negative, red, blue, male, female, you think that's what he's doing? Because I took it as that was literal.
No. So the difference in view here, and the reason why I would give this correction, is because he is looking at the kinetic movement of energy instead of actually looking at the structure itself that's having these energy movements.
Okay.
So he is looking at the transfer of the kinetic energy instead of looking at the two potentials. Basically looking at the fluid moving through the straw instead of looking at the two cups.
Okay, hold that thought. We're about at the top of the hour. Jason, is there anything you want to get in here before I wrap up hour one?
When we get back, can you please define the difference between scalar and information and say which one is smaller? Can we do that?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, so when we come back, we're going to open with that. But if you guys are down with it, when we first open up, I'd like to take just a minute to talk about ether, if you're okay with that, Luke.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so that's going to be hour one. Luke, please offer any websites or contacts or anything you'd like to get out.
Again, you can just reach me at my email, or I do have the Open Science Framework website where my documents are at. I think Rose has the link to it, so we'll have that for the episode and everybody can go and view that. I will say that I did write up a document for everything that I'm talking about here. And once this episode is done, I'm going to edit it and then give it to Rose so that way she can assign it to this episode so you can audibly hear what I'm talking about as well as reread what I'm saying.
All right, it's a document or is it a video?
It's a document.
Okay, so we'll make the document available. Jason, anything you want to add?
Yes, we now have, after being asked quite a lot, a new merch shop. We decided to go with Redbubble, and the link to go to there is redbubble.com/people/crow777/shop. And we'll be putting up lots of different designs so that you can get whatever it is you're interested in. And believe me, we've gotten many requests for that. Also, since it's now the holidays time, if you want to gift someone a membership, you can do that. If you go to the website at crow777radio.com and select Become a Member, if you scroll down, you will see that there is a selection for gift membership. And what happens is, when you select that, you put the person's email in who you want to gift it to. They will receive a password, and they'll be able to take it from there. And there you have it.
All right. This has been hour one of episode 657 with Jason Lindgren and Luke. When we come back, we're going to open up with Ether, and then we're going to get into the question that Rose laid down as we were wrapping up hour one. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, to all my solar work, and unfortunately, I had a program crash out. I should be up and running in a day or two, and I will be working on the 20th member solar video, which is going to cover the solar eclipse from last year because I noticed something in the footage. Also available are the stills and prints of the sun shot in hydrogen alpha. And lastly, you get all the comments, sections, forums, and all that. So I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era, and I hope to see you all logged in for hour two. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.